In this sermon series, we are working our way through the Bible book by book, and today we come to the book of Job. Job is a story covering 42 chapters, and a lot of people know a little bit about Job, but when we start to see how much people know about Job, we find out that most people only know a little bit about him. In fact, they know just enough of the story of Job that they have distorted the story. So today we want to take a look at the whole story of Job, all 42 chapters, and see what it's really about. Now, at the beginning of Job's story, he's having a great life. He's happy. He's healthy. He is filthy rich. He's got a big, glorious family. He's respected by all of his neighbors. Even God respects him. And one day, God is having a conversation with Satan. Satan makes an appearance in the book of Job. It's three times, in fact, in the Old Testament, where Satan makes an appearance. This is the second time here in the book of Job, and it's the most extensive appearance that Satan makes. And God and Satan are having a conversation, and God is bragging about Job, what a good man Job is, and what good character he has. And Satan comes back at God with an argument. Now, I hate to say this, but I'm kind of in agreement with Satan here. It's kind of sad to say that a preacher is in agreement with Satan, but I have to be honest with you that Satan makes a lot of sense in this first chapter of Job. And what Satan says is this. He says, well, God, of course Job is a good guy. Of course Job loves you. It's because you've been so doggone good to him. In fact, you've treated Job better than you've treated anyone. No wonder Job has good things to say about you. And Satan presses the point. He says, I'll tell you what, you let me take all these good things away from Job that you've given him, this wealth and this happy family and all of this stuff, and we'll see what Job has to say about you then. And God, in a very ungodlike way, says, okay, take it all away from him. Just don't take his health away. And we'll see how he does then. And so Satan takes all of Job's blessings away, and he does it in a single day. It is horrible. There's a huge wind that comes up and suddenly kills all of Job's children at once. All 10 of his children are killed when a building collapses on them. And that very same day as his children die, his livestock, his slaves, and his fields are also destroyed, some by enemy armies, some by fire, some by thieves. It is a disastrous day for Job. And while he's very sad and full of grief, he refuses, at least on this day, he refuses to accuse God of causing these disasters. He stays faithful to God. Now, some time passes, we're not sure how much, and God and Satan get together and they have another conversation after all this calamity has occurred. And God says to Satan, hey, yeah, remember we were talking about Job? Look at him. You know, he's still on my side. And Satan comes back with another argument. And Satan says, yeah, but if you take his health away from him, I don't think he's going to be so kind toward you. Let me cover him with itching and let the flesh on his body begin to rot away. And let me sink some disease into his bones. And then we'll see what he does. And God, again, in a very ungodlike way, says, okay, do it. And so Satan destroys Job's health. And yet, at first, Job did not sin against God with his lips. At first. It's not until his friends show up at the beginning of chapter 3 that Job finally loses it. I don't know about you, but there are times we can handle the difficulties that come at us, and it's only when people show up with their advice and try to help us out that we finally lose it all. And this is exactly what happens to Job. The comfort and advice of his friends is what pushes him over the edge. Now, I just want to pause a moment to be sure that we really are reading what's happening in the book of Job. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, so-and-so, she has the patience of Job because, you know, that somebody never complains or anything. But when somebody refers to a person of great patience as having the patience of Job, it's immediately clear to us that that person has never read past the second chapter of Job, because in the third chapter of Job, the guy totally loses it. He loses his integrity. He loses his claims to righteousness. And Job in the third chapter begins to suffer in a most ungodlike way, a most impatient way. So here we have the friends that are showing up, and Job begins to curse God in the third chapter. He curses God because his life is full of sorrow, full of physical pain, full of loss, full of depression. He raises his voice and rails against God. In the book of Job, Job actually accuses God of being sadistic, unfair, uncaring, cold-hearted, mean-spirited. And the more his friends try to point out that Job must have done something to deserve all these troubles, that God wouldn't make an innocent person suffer, the more his friends try to defend God, the more Job curses God and his friends as well. And the majority of the book of Job, for 29 chapters, we have this argument going back and forth between Job and his three so-called friends. Job is arguing that God is treating him unfairly, and the three friends are arguing, no, God would never be unfair. You did something to cause this. God wouldn't do this to you if you hadn't brought it on yourself. Oh, by the way, what did you do? So, 29 chapters, Job and his friends having this argument as to whether God would allow something bad to happen to a good person. They don't manage to come to any sort of agreement. Finally, they stop talking to each other at long last. In fact, we're kind of relieved when that argument ends, because it wasn't going anywhere. And whenever Job and his three friends stop talking, somebody else speaks up, a young man by the name of Elihu. Elihu has been listening all this time, and he's been listening because Job and his friends are older, and they're supposedly the ones who have the wisdom. But when they can't seem to resolve the issue, Elihu speaks up, the young man, and he starts to scold these old men. He says, he goes on for six chapters with his scolding. And he essentially says, you know, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I've been listening to you this whole time, and you keep talking about God as though you knew something about God. And the more you talk about God, the more it's clear to me you don't know anything about God. The more you talk about God, the more it's clear to me that you have forgotten that most of God is mystery. You have little puny ideas about God. And the ideas that you have don't make any sense. You're saying the most idiotic and stupid things about God and about each other and about yourselves. Your understanding of God is so religious, so conventional, so in a box. And so speaks Elihu, scolding these old men. It's an interesting speech. And when he's finished, then God speaks up. And God's speech goes on for four chapters. And in God's speech, we are absolutely floored, because God says some things that none of us would expect God to say. In fact, in the midst of all of Job's troubles, God decides to prosecute him. And so Job is the defendant, and God is the prosecutor. And God has Job on the witness stand, and God, in questioning Job, absolutely eviscerates him. God destroys Job with ridicule and condemnation over all that Job has been thinking and saying. I don't know about you, but I didn't see that coming. I kind of expected God would be tenderhearted and merciful given all the troubles that Job had. But God just attacks him in the courtroom here. Now, that goes on for four chapters, where God absolutely destroys Job. And at the end of God's prosecution, Job speaks up and he says, you're right. I have uttered things I did not understand about you. I have said things about life and it's clear I didn't know what I was talking about. Job, in essence, says, my bad. And then the story takes another very odd twist, something, again, we don't see coming. In fact, it's a rather unsatisfying twist, I think, for many of us. Because whenever Job is done talking, then God says, okay, I'm going to give it all back to you. I'm going to let your wife have some new babies now to replace these children that got massacred. And I'm going to make you double rich from what you were before. And suddenly the book of Job ends with all of these things given to Job as a replacement for what he had lost earlier. Now, what makes the book of Job so difficult to interpret is that it seems to be made up of two very different stories. And these stories don't go together at all, but they get pasted together, tacked together in a rather tacky way into this one book of the Bible. The first story is a rather cute fairy tale type story where there's this guy by the name of Job and he has a bunch of trouble, but he stays faithful and he stays patient. And in the end, God rewards him for his patience and all of his efforts and gives him double back what he lost. It's a cute story. It's the kind of story that we like to see on television or in movies or read in our novels. A character who has problems, stays faithful, follows the rules, keeps his patience, keeps his wits about him, and in the end ends up better off than he was before and lives happily ever after. We love that little fairy tale story. Now, the only problem with that is that we know of very few times in life when that actually happens. You know, whenever I do a funeral for somebody and the family is bereaved and loses a child, you know, it's not as though, oh, you know, give it a few years and, you know, I know you're 70 years old, but, you know, maybe you can have another baby later on. Or a husband dies, a couple's been married a lot of years, and, you know, it's very seldom where we say, you know, you've lost your wife, you've been married 60 plus years, but don't worry, 5 years, you know, maybe the Lord will give you two wives and then you'll be happy and live happily ever after. The problem with this cute little story in the book of Job is that's not usually the way life is. And so we have the other story of Job where this cute little story, this fairy tale story gets ripped in two. And then pasted into the middle of it is a story of an individual who's mad as hell about what's happening to him. He lashes out. He doesn't respond with patience and equanimity. And he's got these friends who seem to be idiots and they say all the wrong things about Job's problems. And then along comes this young man who scolds all these old people as though he himself knows what life is all about. And then Job gets scolded by God, who really puts him in his place. And the second story of Job, the middle of the book, the vast part of the book, is the exact opposite of that cute little story that now gets shoved to the very beginning and the very end of this biblical book. So here's the question that I have. Why did the author of Job take the cute little story and tear it open and put all this garbage into the middle of it? And it's the same question I sometimes ask about life. Why does God take our lives? You know, we have our plans. We have our little things and we just want a good life. Why does God take our lives, which we've sort of planned out, and tear them open and throw a bunch of garbage into the middle of them? Stuff we don't want, stuff we don't ask for, troubles we don't deserve. The book of Job is unsatisfying because it asks the question, why do bad things happen to people who just want to have an ordinary good life? Why do bad things happen to good people? The book of Job raises that question, and it's very unsatisfying because it never answers the question. So what then does the book of Job offer us? Now, as we're moving through these books of the Bible, we're asking three questions of each book. What's the bad news in the book? What's the good news in the book? And what are the practical applications that we can find there? Now, the bad news of Job is pretty clear. Everybody pretty well knows the bad news of Job. And the bad news is that life isn't easy. The bad news is that the things that happened to Job in this story are happening all the time to people. The bad news of Job is the kind of news I see as a pastor in the lives of the people in my church. The bad news is the kind of Job is some of the bad news of Job is stuff that sometimes I see happening to me in my life. And I haven't suffered as much as Job has, but I've had times of loss and sadness and problems with health. And like Job, there are times I feel like I'm in over my head. And like Job, there are times that I don't understand where God is or why God isn't doing something different in all of this. There are times when I read the book of Job that I realize that Job's story is happening to millions of people in this world. In fact, there are millions of people in this world whose lives right now today are worse than what Job went through. If you can, and that's hard to believe, but it's true. There are people in the world today who have it worse than Job had. And it's hard to pay attention to the news. And almost everybody has a little bit of what Job has. If we're not worse than him, we do have bits and pieces. All around us, we see people struggling with cancer, Alzheimer's, divorce, mental illness, drug addiction, homelessness. We see refugees and immigrants, children dying of curable diseases, victims of murder and rape, wicked people who seem to be getting all the perks and powers that this life has to offer. The story of Job prevails in our world today. It's the story of so many people. And we can sympathize with Job's friends because the story of Job is unbearable to watch. We don't have much intelligence or much insight into it. In fact, like Job and his friends, we also tend to take bad situations and make them worse by our inane comments and our know-it-all attitudes. There is no shortage of bad news in Job. And in fact, there seems to be no shortage of bad news in our lives or in our world. So the question of what's the bad news of Job, that was an easy question to answer. The tougher question is, what's the good news of Job? Now, some say that the good news of Job is in the ending, where everything turns out happily ever after. And it is true that the ending of Job seems to be the good news of it, where he ends up double filthy rich instead of just filthy rich, and his wife gives him a bunch of new babies to replace the children that got massacred. At first look, you would think that that's the good news of Job is how it ends. And if that ending makes you feel good, then I don't want to disturb you. I don't want to take that away from you. But honestly, for myself, and I think for some of you who are listening, I don't find that ending to be very satisfying. Now, maybe when I was a child, I was naive enough to think that that was the good news of Job. But as an adult, I find that ending a little too much a fairy tale, a little fishy, not at all ringing true with either other stories in the Bible or with my own experience. So to me, the good news is not in the ending of Job. The ending of Job seems to be there, in fact, to say to us, you need to go back into the middle of the book of Job and find the good news there. And so here's the thing. To me, the good news is not in the ending of Job. To me, the good news is in the scolding that God gives to Job. That may sound odd at first, but I find that that's where the good news is. It's in that scolding that God gives between chapters 38 and 41. And the essence of what God says to Job is this: Job, you're not God. In fact, you're not even smart enough to conceptualize who God is. in God's speech to Job, Job's errors are pointed out. When Job's troubles mounted, he became indignant. I deserve better than this. There are rules for how things should happen. God's not playing by those rules. I'm a good person, and I'm an important person. I shouldn't be treated like this in life. Job is outraged. When life treats Job with all the rottenness that life can muster, Job is humiliated to be seen like this in front of his friends, livid that his friends are blaming him for his troubles. Now, you would think that the scolding God gives him would make matters worse, but that's not true, because the scolding that God gives Job pushes Job all the way down through his humiliation to the rock bottom point of humility. And let's think about those two words. Humiliation is when we think we deserve better, and we're outraged and we're bitter and we lash out because life isn't treating us like we think we should be treated. That's humiliation. Humility, on the other hand, humiliation and humility, they sound the same, but they are actually opposites. Humility is when we go all the way down through our humiliation and hit the bedrock of truth, that we are small. And in this vast, infinite cosmos, we are insignificant, irrelevant, even trivial. And yet, we feel a sense of joy and peace at finally coming down to the truth of who we are. We like not being God. We find peace in not thinking that the world owes us something. Whenever God's speech pushes Job all the way through layer after layer of humiliation, anger, and bitterness, whenever God's speech pushes Job through that region into the final lowest point of humility, it turns out to be a place of peace and grace and joy. And Job says, yes, God, you're right. It's in the words of Job immediately after God's speech that we find the true joy and the true goodness of the book of Job. Now, we sometimes see this. For instance, if a person is terminally ill, oftentimes that person will come to a point of peace after all the outrage, after all the anger, after all of the depression, after all of the humiliation. We often find people who hit that lowest point of life finally finding grace and light and peace in humility. The good news of Job is in the irony of how peaceful and joyful and fulfilling that insignificance and powerlessness can be. So what are the practical applications of Job? Very quickly. Number one, if you have a person that you know who's suffering, don't be like Job's friends. Number two, don't ask the question why. Job and his friends got stuck with that question. If we say, why is this happening to me? The assumption is that we're above that, that somehow we deserve to escape life's pains and life's finitude and limitations. Whenever we ask the question of why, that's not the question humble people ask. The question, why is this happening, is the question humiliated people ask. Don't ask the question why. And finally, from a practical standpoint, don't get stuck in humiliation. Life is full of things where humiliation is right there to trap us. And all of us need to help each other not get stuck at that point, but continue to move down to settle into humility, which is a place of joy and acceptance of our limitations and our finitude rather than humiliation. I love that old Shaker song. 'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free. 'Tis a gift to come down where you ought to be. And when you find your place in the light just right, then you will dwell in the valley of love and delight. The book of Job, seemingly a book of bad news, surprisingly a book of good news, not at the ending, but at its very lowest point where God speaks the truth.